On December 20th, 1979, police found the body of an 18-year-old woman in her family's car that was parked at the Westdale Mall in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Decades passed until finally, 39 years later, through DNA analysis, the killer was finally brought to justice. This is the story of Michelle Martinko. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Miko, and welcome to episode 66 of True Crime Timeline. Now, before we begin, I'd like to give a super big shout out to Nicole from Goldsboro, North Carolina, who left a review. I am so thrilled that you listened to the podcast during your road trip with your husband and mother-in-law, Patty. Thanks to all of you. Also, I appreciate the recommendations for future cases. I recognized one case, but the other two were new to me. I am definitely intrigued and will check them out. Also, I'd like to give a special shout out to Aaron all the way from Vancouver, Canada, who left such an awesome note on the Facebook group page. I am so glad that you liked the show, and I appreciate you leaving that message. It totally made my day. Once again, thank you both for your feedback. Words cannot express how much I appreciate your kind words. And for those of you out there who haven't left a review yet, please do so because it really does help out the show. Also, if you're a new listener and you want to access the older episodes, please check out patreon.com/truecrimetimeline. For $3 a month, you can access the old episodes and also have my deepest gratitude for helping to keep the show going. So with that, let's begin. December 19th, 1979 was supposed to be a special night for high school senior Michelle Martinko. That evening, there was a Kennedy High School concert choir banquet being held at the Sheraton Inn in Cedar Heights, Iowa. Michelle was so excited, and like any 18-year-old high schooler would do, she got totally dressed up for the occasion. With her black dress, brown and white rabbit fur coat, and her hair styled just like Farrah Fawcett, she headed out to the banquet. When the banquet was over, Michelle wanted to go to the Westdale Mall. She wanted to buy a new winter coat there. She asked a close friend to go with her, but her friend had homework to do, so she decided to go alone. When Michelle never came home, her family kept getting more and more worried with each passing minute. They called the police at 2 a.m., and officers went to see if they could track Michelle down. Around 4 a.m. on December 20th, near JCPenney's, a car was spotted in the northeast corner of the Westdale Mall parking lot. It matched the description of the family car that Michelle had been driving that night, which was a 1972 tan four-door Buick Electra. Based on where it was parked, the police noticed that it would have been a long walk from the mall to her car. The officers approached the car. All the doors were locked except one rear door. The keys were also inside of the car. But when they opened up the door, that wasn't all they saw. Officers could see that someone was inside, slumped over in the passenger seat. They had found Michelle, but sadly, it was too late. She had already passed away from what looked like a vicious attack. She had been stabbed multiple times in the face and chest. They could also see that brave Michelle had fought really hard for her life, evidenced by the defensive wounds all over her hands. She had definitely not made it easy for whoever attacked her. She was fully clothed, and it was later confirmed, thank God, that she was not sexually assaulted. Also, she still had money on her, so robbery definitely wasn't a motive. As the police looked around, they realized that one critical piece of evidence was missing, and that was the murder weapon. It was nowhere to be found. In fact, the autopsy couldn't say for sure that it was a knife that had been used. They referred to the weapon as a sharp object. There was a lot of blood evidence due to the number of stab wounds. The blood seemed to be isolated inside the car, since there was no blood found anywhere outside of the car. And this led investigators to believe that the murder did occur while Michelle was inside. There were no fingerprints, but they did find glove prints. And from what I saw, it almost looked like prints from someone wearing like those thick dishwashing gloves. An assistant medical examiner later said that Michelle had died between 8 and 10 p.m. that night. But the window was even tighter than that, because she was last seen leaving the mall around 9 p.m. after going to a jewelry store. Now, the case eventually went cold, but investigators never gave up. They appealed to the public by offering a reward for a limited time. And even that didn't lead them any closer to the person who had committed this terrible crime. On June 19, 1980, a composite sketch was released based on two people who came forward as possible witnesses. The sketch was of a Caucasian man around 6 feet tall who was in his late teens or early 20s. Sadly, this sketch again did not lead to any viable suspects. The police used hypnosis, psychics, investigated hundreds of tips, but again, they got nowhere. As the years passed, the ability to analyze DNA drastically improved. So in 2006, DNA collected from the car's gear shift and Michelle's dress was identified as not belonging to Michelle, but to an unknown male. Somehow during the attack, the killer had accidentally cut himself through the gloves he was wearing. And now, investigators had a sample of his blood. Thankfully, there was enough blood to create a DNA profile. This profile was then uploaded into CODIS, or the Combined DNA Index System, with the hopes that there would be a DNA match. But there wasn't. Without a DNA match, the case went cold again. In May 2017, investigators decided to try another way to solve her case. They reached out to Parabon Nanolabs, which does DNA phenotyping, meaning they could use the DNA to create sketches of what they think the person might look like. Crazy, huh? The sketches that Parabon came back with showed a white male with blonde hair and blue eyes. They tried to show what the man might have looked like back in 1979 when the murder occurred, as well as present day 2017. These sketches were released to the public and generated tons of tips. But once again, it didn't lead them to the killer. In 2018, Parabon offered to help again in a different way. This time, they took the DNA and ran it through a database used to help people research their genealogy and track down relatives. And it worked. They got a hit. They found a woman in Vancouver, Washington, who was a second cousin once removed from the killer. Investigators contacted her and started the process of creating a family tree. And through that, it was determined that the killer had to be descended from one of four sets of great-great-grandparents. Now, all they had to do was start narrowing down this family tree to find the killer. Investigators eventually found a woman whose DNA indicated that she was first cousins with the killer. And this was huge because based on the family tree, that meant that the killer had to be one of three brothers from the Burns family who lived in Iowa. Investigators now needed to figure out which brother was the killer. They needed to get their hands on DNA samples from all three of them. So, the three brothers were put under surveillance. And one by one, the brothers were eliminated until the last one, Jerry Burns, was left. Burns was married with kids back in 1979. He would have been around 25 at the time that Michelle had been killed. There didn't appear to be any connection between him and Michelle, so if he was the killer, that meant that she had been randomly targeted. Based on all this, he hardly fit the profile that they had imagined would be the killer back in 1979. But he was the only one left, so they needed his DNA to be 100% sure. They started following him and waited for an opportunity to collect his DNA. Finally, they got their chance. On October 29th, 2018, he went to a place called Pizza Ranch to eat. While there, he drank a soda through a straw. And when he left, investigators got the soda cup and sent it for testing. This time, it was a match. His DNA matched the DNA found on Michelle's dress and was also consistent with the DNA profile from the car's gear shift. They had found Michelle's killer. On December 19th, 2018, officers went to his place of business with a hidden camera to get his reaction when asked about the murder. At first, they showed him the Parabon sketch and told him that someone had contacted them saying that he resembled the picture. Now, I watched his video, and I have to admit that he did not act like someone innocent. And I know we can't predict how someone really can or should act in any given situation, but he did act strange. I mean, if someone showed up asking me if I murdered someone, I would deny it. I mean, wouldn't you? But that's not what he did. He didn't say much, but when he did talk, he made comments about how the sketch didn't really look like him. Then they confronted him about the DNA. Again, he stayed super calm and just kept on saying to retest the DNA. He couldn't seem to give a reason why his DNA was present at the crime scene either. Police had enough. They arrested him and he was charged with the first degree murder of Michelle Martinko. On January 25th, 2019, Burns pleaded not guilty to the first degree murder charges. He stuck to his story of having no recollection of killing Michelle and couldn't give any type of explanation again on why his DNA was found at the crime scene. The Burns trial started in February 2020. During the trial, the video of Burns being transported from his workplace to the Cedar Rapids Police Department was played. During that car ride, when asked about what happened that night, he responded that he couldn't recollect what happened. Again, he's not saying that he didn't do it or that the police had the wrong guy. He's just saying that he couldn't recollect that night. The pathologist who performed the autopsy testified at the trial. Jurors heard about the defense wounds on Michelle's hands as she tried to fend off the attack. The pathologist stated that Michelle was in a lot of motion and demonstrated by holding his hands up with his palms forward in front of his face. Jurors heard how she had been stabbed 11 times in her lungs and aorta. She also had multiple lacerations to her face and neck. Overall, she had a total of 29 wounds made by a sharp weapon. Jurors heard how she had been found with her dress pulled up. Her pantyhose was still in place, and she had not been sexually assaulted. Jurors also heard how there were no fingerprints, but instead there were prints from gloves, indicating that the person had planned the attack. A jailhouse informant also took the stand. He stated that Burns never admitted to killing or not killing Michelle, but Burns did make a strange statement to him. He said that there was a time when he was playing a card game with Burns, and Burns was getting upset because he was losing. Burns then told the jailhouse informant that if he kept winning, he would have to take him to the mall. And you have to admit that that's a really strange comment for someone to make, again, if they're innocent. Prosecutors argued that the DNA evidence was irrefutable. Burns had to have been in Michelle's car. They also said that her murder was premeditated, evidenced by the fact that he had been wearing gloves to make sure he left no fingerprints. During the trial, the defense really had little to work with. They tried to focus on finding flaws with the collection and retention of the DNA evidence. Specifically, they argued that the dress had not been properly stored all these years. They argued that the dress that had been DNA tested had been stored with other items like her pantyhose and underwear. They also argued that there could have been a DNA transfer. Burns admitted to being at the mall that night, and this meant that his DNA was present at the mall. And if the killer was also at the mall, the DNA could have transferred from Burns to the killer. I personally felt that both of these arguments were pretty weak, and the jury must have felt the same way. Because on February 24th, 2020, the jury found Burns guilty of first-degree murder. He was sentenced on August 7th, 2020, to life in prison without the possibility of parole. He filed a motion for a new trial, but the motion was denied. Now, this story isn't over, unfortunately, because he recently hired famous Kathleen Zellner as his new attorney. And you might recognize her name from her representation of Stephen Avery on that Netflix show, Making a Murderer. They are fighting the DNA evidence by saying that the lower court allowed a warrantless extraction of Burns' DNA. And we're going to have to wait to see what happens with this. Michelle Martinko was known to be friendly, sweet, and kind. In high school, she excelled in her studies while also participating in choir and theater. She was also a member of the baton twirling squad when she was a sophomore. She had big plans for the future. She was planning on attending Iowa State University, majoring in interior design. Her mother said that she loved music and was a beautiful singer. You will never be forgotten, Michelle Martinko. So that's a wrap. Thank you so much for listening. Check out the True Crime Timeline Instagram page and Facebook group for pictures about the episode. I'd also like to thank and acknowledge the many sources that were used for the episode. This podcast would not be possible without these sources. And if you'd like a list of the sources, want to request a case, or just say hello, leave a message at truecrimetimeline.com. So with that, take care and stay safe, everyone.